Hello and welcome along to the Property Academy podcast by Opus Partners. I'm your host, Steve McKnight.
And I'm Andrew Nicholl.
And today on the show, we are so pleased to be joined by Martin Hawes, one of New Zealand's top financial experts and author of 23, soon to be 24 books. Martin, welcome along to the show.
Yeah, hi there, guys.
This is a pretty exciting one for me because I've read a lot of Martin's books. I didn't realise actually there were so many. Maybe I'm not as much of a fanboy as I thought I was, but Martin was New Zealand's most trusted financial advisor when he was a financial advisor for so many years. So he's the gold standard when it comes to financial experts, in my opinion.
And so the challenge for today, Martin, is we are going to take your 45 years of investing experience and, you know, many, many decades as an author and financial advisor, and we're going to condense it down into about 15 minutes. So take me back to when you started as a financial advisor. What sort of things were Kiwis investing in back in the 80s?
Pretty much shares and property, and of course that perennial term deposits. Term deposits have been a constant theme throughout New Zealand's investment history. But the thing that was really lacking back in the 80s was any kind of managed fund or any kind of way of anybody taking money and managing it on behalf of people. That didn't happen in the same way.
Okay, so back then it was a lot more, can I call it direct investments, where people would own specific shares rather than investing through, for example, today people go through index funds.
Yes, that's right. It was DIY. They might have had a share broker. They might have even known people in property that they might have got some advice from, but it would be on a fairly casual kind of basis. Bob Jones and then later Ollie Newlands came in and started running their property seminars, and they were getting like hundreds of people, maybe thousands of people to a weekend seminar. We tagged along behind that a bit, and we put $500, which, you know, you put in today's money, it'd be $1,500 or something like that for a day's seminar. You'd get 400 or 500 people coming. You know, really, really big numbers on both property and shares. Now, this is back in 86 and 85 and eventually 87. The 87 crash came in and put a very dark line under that. And in 86, you could sell a seminar and get hundreds of people, but in 87, you couldn't sell one for love nor money.
And so if there wasn't really the financial advisors like we know them today, what made you decide to be a financial advisor?
Well, I came at it through, you know, I've had a strange career, and it's not one that a careers advisor would have. I've said, well, you're here at the moment as a 20-year-old and you want to get there as a 70-year-old. I was doing these seminars, and I've always done a lot of public speaking, whether, you know, it was head boy at school or president of the Students Association and that sort of stuff. So I've been happy enough in front of a microphone. I had been dabbling, and dabbling is probably the right word, in shares and to a lesser extent property myself, and was invited to come and present some of these seminars, which I did. I felt that I didn't have enough knowledge, but I upskilled myself pretty quickly. And from that, I just gradually grew into giving advice mostly on property, but also business. And then when my family trust book came out in 1995, I decided that I was going to really concentrate on simply writing and speaking. Then gradually I moved into financial advice just because I had so many people wanting to talk to me and get some advice from me. So I then had 25 years as a financial advisor. I've now gone full circle back to only being a speaker and a writer.
And if we think about those seminars back in the 80s with, you know, Bob Jones, Ollie Newland, yourself, people paying $500, a lot of money back then, to come to a one-day seminar, how sophisticated was that information?
I think it was right for the market. I don't think it was unsophisticated, and I certainly wouldn't call Bob Jones and not Ollie Newlands either actually unsophisticated. They knew their stuff. We knew our stuff pretty well as well. But we were very focused on getting one big idea across, and that is that as an investor, you should be looking at what income can I derive from this investment. So what's the yield? And not, as they talk about now, gross yields, but actually net yields. And this didn't matter whether it was residential property or industrial property. Industrial property is my favorite type of property because it's so simple. Well, it's relatively simple. But we really focused on getting that idea of yield across. We also were focused, it was a much less efficient market in those days. It was quite an inefficient market. And so we were looking for deals, for property deals, for example, that had a twist in them. Mm. When it came to shares, we were looking at PE ratios, price earnings ratios, dividend yields, price to net assets, and those kinds of things. Fundamental valuation numbers that people should have been keen on then, interested in then, and they should be now too. I mean, the deal is much the same as it was then. Sophisticated? Well, there were no PowerPoint presentations or anything like that. No music or lights or anything like that. It was just, we would stand up and talk to people, basically.
And it's really interesting thinking about the fact that, you know, it would have been much more, or you might not have had internet access even back then. Like, people didn't have the ability to get the mountain of knowledge that you can find on the internet today back then. So if we fast forward over the last 34 years, what's the same today as it was back then and what's completely different?
The yield, or it ought to be, you know. Yeah. So you buy for yield and let the capital gain look after itself. If you're getting a decent yield, to me, that's everything. When it comes to shares, it's much the same. It's a little bit different because a lot of very good companies that have given shareholder returns that are just absolutely wonderful for very long periods of time have never paid a dividend and have only recently started actually making money. But they're a huge company. I'm thinking of Amazon here, which is one of my favorite companies. If you look at Amazon, it listed 27 years ago. If you'd asked me about it, then, you know, should I buy Amazon? I'd never given much advice on direct investments, I probably would have said something like, well, you know, it's a book retailer and yeah, you could buy it and it'll probably do all right. But, you know, it's never going to be spectacular. Well, for 27 years, Amazon has given a shareholder return of 33.5% per annum for 27 years. You know, I mean, that is just stunning. There's nothing else that I can find that's anything like that. Apple's close, it's 31%. Some of these big tech companies have really given fabulous returns over very long periods of time. And I think for my money, and it's certainly where a lot of my money is invested, I think that's going to continue. If not continue, actually the curve steepen.
Can I ask you, Martin, as well? So there's some things that are the same over the last 36 years. Just before we hit recording, you said consistency is very overrated. So sometimes you don't mind contradicting what you said in one book compared to the other, because over 36 years or 38 years, you're allowed to change your mind. So what's something you've changed your mind about over the years?
I'm not as keen on residential property, and maybe we should talk about the whys of that later, but that would be one. I mean, I was very keen on that. I'm still very keen on industrial property, largely because it's four concrete walls and a tin roof and, yeah, and not terribly much else. I think that would probably be the really big one that I have changed on. In fact, I'd say it's less me changing. I think it's more residential property has changed, or some of its features have become more apparent.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting one to me, because I after reading your books, I always thought Martin Hawes doesn't really like residential property. He likes other investment types. Tell us why.
First of all, very high price and therefore very low yields. So as an investment proposition, it doesn't really stack up like it used to. You know, you used to be able to buy residential property on a net yield of 7 or 8%, something like that. Now it might be 1 or 2. Second, I think there are too many people toying with it rather than going into it like it's a whole business, you know. And I think residential property, in fact, any property requires time, effort, and energy. You've got to put a lot into it. You can't go into it in a half-hearted sort of way. I think you'd be better with managed property. The third one, and this one has been consistent right through, is politics. housing, which is what we're talking about, has always been a public policy issue. Politicians will always, waving my hands, inverted commas sign, interfere with it. In other words, they will play with that market. And we saw that with the Labor government over the last 3 years in particular, with various, you know, tax and other considerations. I think, well, residential property has always been a political football, but it will continue to be because politics is now so bifurcated. It's now, there's very little in the middle anymore. People are either on one side or they're on the other. And I think our government could well seesaw backwards and forwards, but housing, residential property will go with it. The fourth one is not really a negative, but it's something that you have to look at, and that's that it's a very opaque market. So I could say to you, what sort of, you know, take a decent time period. Normally I'd say 50 years, but let's take 25 years. Tell me what the returns are on residential property. And you wouldn't be able to tell me. I'd be able to tell you exactly what the share market is because we don't know the deals. We may know because it's a matter of public information that somebody bought that property at a certain price and they sold it at another price. But the 20 years of ownership, we've no idea what money they took from it by way of rent or subdividing a section or something like that. And we don't know what they've put into it. So it's quite opaque. So from not so much me, I personally don't mind that because I care about the one property that I would be buying. But if you are an actuary or you are some kind of investment analyst, then you wouldn't like that because you simply can't figure out what the volatility is, let alone what the returns are.
Really interesting answer.
And if we think, Martin, about, you've seen property change over the last 40, 50 years, where do you think property will go over the next 20 years?
That's a really interesting one. I mean, I've long said that, and this is one of the negative things of residential property. I've long said that eventually a government will get its act together and they will try to hold down the price of property. They'll probably overdo it. Nobody really wants property to fall in value. That would be, we've had that for the last 2 or 3 years or so. Nobody wants property to fall in value. They'd like it just to go up with the amount of inflation. So the next 20 years, I think when this downside is finished, we might see quite a sharp upward bounce. And my reason for that is that in the old days, and I would argue still now, you need to consider the gap between a brand new property, the cost for a brand new property, a brand new house, and a second-hand one. Nobody seems to be talking about that very much. No, nobody seems to be analysing it. But given, well, a few months ago I had builders here, and, you know, given what tradies charge now, the price to build a house is going up. But the cost of an existing house has actually been going down. So that gap must be widening a fair bit. Now, there's a few housing companies that are trying to innovate and build a lot cheaper and so forth and build at scale. But New Zealand still doesn't really build at scale. I mean, there's a few people who are probably building a few hundred houses a year, but that's, you know, by Australian, US, UK standards, that's diddly squat or nothing. But that gap, brand new or secondhand compared to replacement, we ought to be watching that very carefully. So there may well be a bounce. And then, of course, at the same time, you've got the Brightline test being lowered. You've got the deductibility of interest coming back in. I couldn't say amused, but I'm watching carefully the comments on, you know, as the deductibility of interest. To me, that's the big one. Is coming back, and there are a lot of commentators virulently against that and calling it a tax cut and so forth, which is a serious nonsense. It's bringing back a basic principle, which is that if you were buying an asset to derive an income, the costs for that, including interest, are deductible for everything else. Why shouldn't they be on property?
But I think that goes to your point about how housing is such a political football. And the narrative around this interest deductibility has been so unfair over the last couple of years.
And in terms of the mistakes that you've seen investors make, you must have seen so many over the years. What would you say are the main mistakes that Kiwi investors make?
And I've made them over the years too, and I'm quite happy to write about them and talk about them. I think the number one, and I learned this lesson really well in the 87 crash. Now, people who weren't there start rolling their eyes and think, oh God, they're on about that again. But it was a major crash. You know, the index went from something like 3,900 to 1,400 over a period of 2 or 3 years. And then property, particularly commercial property, followed it down as well, maybe not quite by that much. I think over-enthusiasm would be one mistake, especially during boom times. But I'm thinking now that even worse is over-pessimism, people not investing. So at the moment, we've got a huge amount going on in technology. I'm very keen on technology, AI and medical devices and biotechnology and so forth, lots of different things like that. But at the same time, we've got two quite severe wars going on, either of which could spill over and expand into other areas. We've got China and the US starting to go to head to head. We've got an axis forming with China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, which is wanting to stand up against them. So we've still got a really difficult geopolitical situation. And that's putting people off. And at the same time, they're saying, and I can get 6% at the bank. well, that's all very well, except that 6% gets taxed, which brings it down to about 5%. It taxes at 17.5%. And then you take inflation off, which is 4%. You're really only getting about 1%. You know, so yes, it might be holding its own, but only just. Really interesting. If you go back to the 80s, we had really high interest rates, and people would look at the headline interest rate you could get. The best term deposit rate that I've been able to find is something a little north of 16%, so 16.1, 16.9. If you do that same exercise, you take the tax off it, it's, say, 17.5%. It comes down to, working from memory, about 13.5%. And you'd say, well, a return of 13.5%. After tax, isn't that fantastic? Well, no, it's not, because inflation at the time was running at 15 point something or other. And so you were actually getting a negative real rate of return. I don't think people, this is another fault, I think, of Kiwi investors. We look at the headline, but we don't actually just run some pretty simple calculations.
And so, thinking about a man who's invested for a number of years, what's your biggest regret as an investor?
It's that various things have come in my life, like a couple of marriage breakups and various changing of houses. They have meant that I haven't been able to invest all the way through. There have been times when I've had to cash up my investments to be able to buy a different house or divide my relationship property, that sort of thing. So I'm trying very hard with my grandchildren for them to look at their KiwiSavers. I'm putting money into them. Various other members of the family are putting money into them. And those, by law, will have to stay the same, at least until they go to buy their first house. Mm. And then I've changed my will so that each of my four grandchildren would get $50,000, but they're not going to get it paid into their bank account to have a big party or buy a motorbike or something. They're going to get it so that that's going to go into their KiwiSaver. The only way they can get that out is to buy their first house. And then anything that goes into KiwiSaver is locked in until retirement. And, you know, unless they have really bad health, something, like a bad health issue or bad financials or something. So I think it's that continuity of investing. You look at Warren Buffett. And, you know, he's just invested all the way through since the 50s or 60s. And he's been very consistent. And he's got another one who's got a 20-odd percent return over the very long term.
It's really interesting. The separation is something that all of a sudden you're so heavily exposed to having to liquidate your assets and pay someone out. And it's something that, I mean, whilst you do have some control over it, you know, that could just be one of those things that happens in life that Maybe you do have no control over it, and all of a sudden you're financially having to split things up. That must be a real challenge for especially someone like yourself who probably does everything in his life to prepare for the worst case scenario.
Yes, life gets in the way. Things happen. And, well, for me, I've had to cash up. It's one of the really good things of KiwiSaver is it's bloody hard to get back out of it. You know, you've got to get old or you've got to buy your first house. That's about it.
It's a really clever thought about giving your money to the grandkids, because then you know that the KiwiSaver provider has to authorise that payment out at some stage. So it's about as protected as it can be.
Right, let's wrap it up there. But please don't forget to rate, review and subscribe to the podcast. Really does help us get the message out to more people. And hey, we're going to have Martin back next week to talk about, well, what you invest in at different stages of your life. So make sure you tune in. Thanks for listening to the Property Academy podcast. I'm your host, Steve McKnight.
And I'm Andrew Nicholl.
We're going to be back again tomorrow with even more daily strategies, tactics and insights to help you get the most out of the New Zealand property market. Until next time.